Session number 3970, wheel number 5.
Goldsmith, reel 5.
When did you change your name?
I changed my name, I would have thought, within the first year. And I think this was a general order and this was compulsory. It was not only the change of name, it was also change of army number. All the A Company pioneers had numbers beginning with 130 or 1380 and very low numbers, and they were changed afterwards and became higher numbers on the change of name. And I think the change of name had something to do with the change in policy that refugee, technically enemy aliens, would be allowed to serve in units other than the Pioneer Corps and to be allowed to rise above the rank of sergeant. In fact, become officers.
What does that have to do with what your name is?
The point is that Goldsmith, to which I changed my name from Goldschmidt, is an English-sounding name and would not immediately be obvious if you were taken prisoner of war. As with the name of Goldschmidt, the Germans would immediately become suspicious.
Yes. You just translated your name.
Some people took entirely different names, yes. You see, change of name is nothing new to Jewish people. I don't know whether you know why there are such a majority of certain names amongst Jewish people. You see, Jewish people used to be known, and are still known in Israel today, by their first name, son of their father, right? In fact, I have a photo stud of a will of my father's great-grandfather, or thereabouts, where to do with his great-great-grandmother's will, where three of six children signed their name in Hebrew. It was only during the Napoleonic War, I got it right, that the Jews in Germany were compelled to take, let us call it, civil names. And a lot of them became known by the place from which they came, or the trade in which they were employed, and also a lot of them had to buy their name. So the more money they were able to afford, the better sounding name they were able to get. Now, this has somehow or other perpetuated itself in this. You will find this in the same thing happening in the army again. Of course, the money wasn't the object in that instance.
Why did you choose to translate your name instead of choosing a new one?
Because, first of all, I liked it. Secondly, a certain amount of family loyalty, and I could see no good reason for changing it.
No, in fact, I'm surprised usually when people tell me what their name was and now they have some entirely different name.
Yes.
I feel one really ought to be attached to one's name. It surprises me.
No, I mean, I may have a rather old-fashioned type of first name, but it's not very common in this country. In fact, I can only think of two or three prominent people who have the same. One was Herbert Samuel and one was Herbert Morrison. But you won't find many. I mean, you'll be very hard pushed to find go through a whole school today and find a child with that name. I think you would be extremely hard pushed, you see. So.
You could have had your own name back again afterwards if you'd wanted.
Oh, yes. There's nothing to stop you. I mean, anybody can change his name in this country as often as he likes. You can change it by deed poll. That is no problem. But what is the advantage? I don't want to change mine. Oh, I see. You mean actually to change it back again to my original name? Oh, I think I wouldn't do that, for the simple reason is that people would have difficulty in spelling. You have to spell your name every single time, and I can't see. No, that I wouldn't do. But certainly, I was never ashamed of my name in the first instance. If anybody asked me, yes, you see, there it is, spelled the original way. You see.
When you enlisted?
Yes, you see, they're spelled the original way.
I shouldn't have thought a German intelligence officer would be much led astray by someone having an English name, since he would speak fluent German and perhaps even speak English with a German accent.
Ah, yes, but you see, the thing is this. He wouldn't be led astray, no. But you see, look at it the opposite way round, from the other side. If you have a group, say a German intelligence officer is dealing with 50 English prisoners, right? Now, the name of Goldsmith wouldn't immediately stand out, as the name of Goldschmidt would immediately stand out, right? So if somebody was called Goldschmidt, he would immediately cotton on to him and put him through the mill, right? Now, if he interviewed somebody called Goldsmith, he would have difficulty. You see, I wouldn't have to admit that I spoke German. Right?
But you'd speak English with a German accent.
Yes, but wait a minute. His English has to be sufficiently good for him to detect that. Right? In the first instance. Right? Now, there are cases, a few of the ex-pioneers were taken prisoners. And as far as I know, there were no problems. And in one or two instances, they were very successfully shielded by their colleagues. So, I think that process was absolutely correct and taken in the best interest of all concerned. Oh, no. This was, again, a decision taken by the government that I wholeheartedly approve of. In this instance, everybody else approves of it, you see. But even with hindsight, that is correct. Even on what one knows today, so certainly there's nothing wrong with that decision. No. And on the question of naturalization, this, of course, was offered as a matter of right. Not as compulsion, it was offered as a matter of right after the end of the war. And I can well remember coming for an interview, and amongst the other questions I was asked was, Sergeant, have you any relations in this country? I said, yes, sir, my wife. Your wife is no relation. Did you know that? A wife is no relation. What? Your father is, your brother is, your uncle is, your cousin is, your wife is no relation, not in law.
In your case, your wife is a relation.
Ah, that is a slightly different matter, yes. I take that point. But the fact, a wife is no relation. Having enlisted and settled there, we were immediately given 7 days or 10 days embarkation leave. It was called embarkation leave or disembarkation leave, if you like. My mother's cousin, as he then was in the army, in the Pay Corps, was stationed in Bradford. So I sent a telegram to say that I had arrived and I was coming home. And I arrived home, and the first thing I was told, that their daughter was going in the army, had volunteered to join the ATS, and was going 2 days later, which of course pleased me no end, because that was one of the reasons I had come home. So she went to Halifax to join up, and I went back to Liverpool to finish my army training. And I was posted after a month or so to 69A Company, which was the senior Alien Pioneer Corps company in, with its headquarters in Darlington. And we were employed mainly on helping Royal Engineers and Royal Ordnance Corps, and we were in fact considered later Darlington's own, because the company was stationed there for 3 years, and while Darlington was at weekends the centre of a lot of for a lot of soldiers, because it is right in the centre of Kettrick, Barnet Castle, etc. During the week, it only had a section of REs, a section of ordnance, and our headquarters section plus one or two others. And we were well liked, and I can well remember taking part in wartime parades like Battleship Week and Savings Week and all these parades. And we went on detachment to various outlying places, and I can remember Hawes and Stokesley, and what was the other? Eventually we ended up in Weldrake, but that was, oh, 2 years late. That was already 2 years late. Anyway, we spent from, I joined the company in in March 42, and we spent in County Durham and in Yorkshire, in various places, about 2 years. And in between, after 6 months, I rose to the lowest rank in the British Army, being made an acting, unpaid, local Lance Corporal, the lowest of the low. And this was particularly so, as I found myself as a competitive young man in a company which had been in existence for 2 years, of men who came out of concentration camp together, been through the Kitchener camp together, been in France together, been through the London Blitz together, and who knows what else. And then, having put in charge of them a young boy as an NCO who knew nothing of life, or so they thought, and if nothing else, it taught me how to, at least one attempts to deal with older men. And on the whole, I had very few problems in that respect. The other events during that period was that I got engaged to my second cousin. And then in 1944, it must have been already, we were eventually attached to a field company RE in a place called Weldrake, and there is one RE field company to each division, and this was attached to the Guards Armour Division, to a corps which included the Guards Armour Division, and I think it was 15 Scottish Lowland Division. Anyway, the point was that this was to be one of the spearheads for the invasion, and at that time there was already talk of invasion. And for some reason or other, we were taken away from there. But before that, we had been to Hull to be trained in loading and unloading ships, and we were put together with the dockers, and we learned we were taught how to handle material on and off ships, which was important because on embarkation, like the invasion of Normandy, this came in handy. So from Weldrake, I got married, and in fact, I was AWOL technically when I got married, because I got married on a Sunday and my pass didn't start until the Monday morning, but could never caught at that. So remember coming back of the company moved in the meantime to Otley, and in fact I must have had a telegram to report back to Otley. And I remember coming to the camp, and the first thing I was told, all army leave had been stopped. Like, we got married on the 26th of March 1944, and this must have been the beginning of April, So this was in preparation of the Second Front. And in Otley, we were, funny enough, employed on building prison of war camps for... So we come full circle. Of course, Otley was rather useful because I could go home at weekends and sometimes with an evening pass back to Bradford. And then we were moved from there to... No, not to Hull, to near Barnsley, Bolton-on-Dern. And I remember being called together one morning. Of course, now we remember it was the 6th of June, and we were told that it was the... and we had the order of the day from Montgomery read out about the invasion. That was in... We were in Bolton-on-Dern. It may well have been that we went after that to Hull rather than before that. Anyway... From Bolton-on-Dern, we went to a staging camp near St. Leonard's on the south coast, which was, for all intents and purposes, technically already considered overseas from a security point of view and a communication letter writing. For instance, we got green letters. I don't know whether you know what a green letter is. You know what a green letter is. Incidentally, I've just come across black letters, which are called green letters. You never seen one of those. I'll show you one afterwards, rather amusing. It's a New Zealand one, or Australian. They must have run out of green ink, and they printed them in black and written on top green letters so that they served the same purpose. Whilst we were there, we were employed in St. Leonard's on building gun emplacement for a heavy ACK battery, which were fighting the Doodlebugs at the time. And it was all rather exciting and not at all dangerous. And I remember Mary Churchill was an ATS officer in that particular battery. And for some reason or other, they decided to institute afternoon tea. So they came with huge buckets of tea and rock buns. And these rock buns were as described. And we already had green letters. That's why the remark about green letters. And so... day or so later, must have written home and made a remark about it, and the catering officer comes out and says, Corporal, yes sir, if you have any complaints about the food, I wish you would make it to me, not write it in your letters. I said, sir, I didn't make any complaints about the food. You wrote that the rock buns lived up to their name. I said, yes sir, that is true. That is a statement of fact, not an opinion. Of course, he should have never opened the green letter. He had no right whatsoever as a unit officer to open a green letter. They should only be open, so it should only be subject to censorship at base. Anyway, eventually we went to and embarked, and we landed in Arromanches across 3 nights in Foxholes beaches. And we went to Caen, and we were on the south side of Caen. In fact, that was the nearest I ever got to the front line. And on the second night, they came to the southern outskirts of Snuffy supplies, and I remember one occasion when a pioneer company, they used their mugs to break the bottles and the cases, and it got so bad that they were all lying flat out on the... And so eventually it was disbanded. And we were taken to Bruges, and a pioneer company keep them up to strength. So what they did, they dissolved some of the companies to make the others up to strength. And I eventually landed up at 74 Company in Antwerp, and an exciting time in Antwerp because it was fairly safe in the work. We worked, in fact, on a very secret instrument at the time. It was an ultraviolet fixture work. It was a Remi section that did the work, but we sort of were their laborers, the best way of putting it. But it was exciting because Antwerp had doodlebugs and rockets, far more concentrated than London, because it had double the number in half the time on a third of the space, so you work that one out. In fact, it was so bad, it didn't seem to worry us a great deal, and we just put up with it. we had a member of the Black Watch with us in the guard room for a short period, who had come with the 51st Highland Division all the way from El Alamein with Montgomery. And he must have been picked up in Antwerp, and he was put on a charge and to be sent back to the unit, and he was in our guard room for a short while in the intervening period. And he begged on his hands and knees, can he please be put back to the front line, because then at least he knows where it's coming from, he can't stand that any longer. So it gives you an idea. And then I was posted to Sols, where we were given a certain amount of training, and it's actually very interesting. We worked a fiddle, and very successfully. Everything is allowed in the army, provided it's not against the law, and it wasn't against the law, it was a fiddle. You see, I was a full corporal near war substantiation. In other words, my 6 months was nearly up when the company was dissolved. Now, you revert to the rank of private, right? Now, the company was dissolved. I simply kept up my two stripes, as did everybody else who was in the same position, and nobody said anything. In fact, at one point, we were marching three platoons through Bruges in charge of three full corporals who were technically private, so if anything would have happened, there would have been an almighty row. We came to 74th Company, or for some reason, the major said, all right, you won't get paid, but you can keep your stripes up. So we came to the interpreter's pool, and when you were sent out from the interpreter's pool, you were sent out as a lance corporal. But for the reason that we kept our two stripes up, we were sent out as full corporal. So through that, eventually, I became a war substantiated sergeant, and it affected my gratuities at the end of the war. So it was a successful fiddle, and perfectly illegal fiddle, but it wasn't breaking any laws. Now, when we had finished our training in... on the day peace broke out, if one can put it that way, I was in Antwerp, and Brussels at that time was considered the haven for any British soldier on the Western Front. Brussels was, for me, a notable place also, as our first son was born whilst I was there, whom I didn't see for 3 months thereafter. And because I don't think we got leave till he was 3 months old, yes. The first leave must have been from Germany, yes, already. So anyway, from the interpreter's pool, we were sent out, and I remember that three of us were sent to 30 Corps HQ in Nienburg, or so we were told. So I asked where Nienburg was, and I was... They told me it was on the River Weser, so I asked them how it was spelled, so they started spelling, and of course then it turned out it was Nienburg under Weser. So we got to 30 Corps HQ, and 30 Corps HQ turned around and said, no, we don't need interpreters, we've finished with the war. So they sent us to a provincial military government HQ in Hanover, and they said, well, we don't need you, but we'll send you out on detachment, and... you wait here. And 3 days later they came to us to tell us we were going to Oldenburg, which of course was the military government in charge of the town in which I was born. And this was quite by chance and in no way had anything to do with where I was born. So we ended up in Oldenburg, where I spent 6 months as interpreter, nine months possibly, as interpreter, and rose to the rank of sergeant, and most of my time was spent in the finance department, which was very interesting work indeed, because we supervised the county council and also the banks, including a branch of the Reichsbank, and one had to understand, or at least try to understand, the subjects, as it was quite impossible to interpret successfully. And amongst other things, I did one or two stints of interpreting in court because there were prosecutions of German bank officials, and I had to undertake that interpreting. And that had to be particularly exact because some of the German defending solicitors knew sufficient English to pick one up if one made a mistake. I was.
Did anyone recognise you as having
come to that in a minute? Yes, I was particularly fortunate in that whilst most of the officers were there mainly for wine, women, and song, or at least they gave that impression, and their efficiency in instances left something to be desired. The full colonel in charge of the military government, and particularly the lieutenant colonel in charge of the finance department, were capable, efficient, and knew their job. As to your question as to whether anybody recognized me, the answer to that is yes, definitely. Of course, amongst other things, one of the jobs that we had to do was to supervise the opening, or rather, the law wars for military government, that any member of the Nazi party who had a safe deposit at the bank was not allowed to open it for the first time unless in the presence of a British officer. And of course, it wasn't much good of a British officer going to supervise the opening of the bank deposit box without an interpreter. So this was one of the jobs. And I can remember one occasion going with a major to Delmenhorst, and in fact to the Stadtsparkasse, which was the bank at which we had banked. Now, it must be remembered that I virtually left the town at the age of 14, although I went back once or twice on holiday, and I was in sergeant's uniform without any indication of even being an interpreter when a woman walked in to open her safe deposit and asked me whether I wasn't the son of Mr. Goldschmidt, i.e. she must have recognized me, A, from my German accent, and B, from my likeness to my father, when, rightly or wrongly, I told her in no uncertain manner that A, I wasn't, and B, if I was, it was none of her damn business, much to the amusement of the major to whom I explained the situation afterwards. I was also recognized once, peculiarly enough, in a swimming pool in Oldenburg. And a number of people I went to see in Delmenhorst, including the mayor, who was a friend of an uncle of mine whom I hadn't known before. And of course I told him who I was. But very few people. Also, there was a rather amusing incident where on one occasion the colonel asked me to go with two officials from the German County Council to three of the local towns to get the reports, which were very slow in coming in for a specific subject. So we went to Delmenhorst and went to the town hall, and these two Oldenburg officials told the two local officials exactly what was required about the report, and it was urgent, and the military government wanted it, etc. And there were all the usual excuses when I took over and explained to them in German exactly what was required, and of course the answer came back is "Jawohl, Herr Feldwebel." Then I heard the two Delmenhorst officials go in the corner and one say to the other, "I'd love to know where he was born." And I thought to myself, well, if you take a stone and throw it out the back window, you'll just about hit the place where I was born. But they never found out. The time in Oldenburg was very useful in that it gave one an insight of administration and of local government and even into banking to some extent. And I think I gained a lot from that time. Although, of course, the war being over, everybody had a hankering of getting out the army as soon as possible. And one counted up one's points when, much to my surprise, one day the office sergeant rang down and asked for me to come down. He said, "I got a telegram from the War Office for me." When I came down, he informed me that it was a telegram from the War Office asking whether I wished to be released under an agricultural bulk release. Of course, horticulture qualifying under agriculture. So my answer to that was, "When do I go?" "Yesterday." Of course, it still took a few days to arrange. And I ended up in Nantwich in Cheshire in the last Pioneer Corps DMOP Center, and being of all substantiated size, and of course we had a lazy time and did nothing there, not like some of the poor chaps below the rank of sergeant who still had to do all sorts of fatigues and God knows what. And I came back to London about the 10th of May or thereabouts in 1946, i.e. precisely 6 years after the date on which I was interned. I had been on leave once, two or three times in between, but not very often. And sometime in between, I had an interview regarding my naturalization, which came through after my demob. And in fact, the end of my war story is really that as a technically enemy alien, I had to go and register with the police. So I went to Golders Green Police Station in sergeant's uniform, went in the front door and asked where the aliens department was, and I was told round the back. So I went round the back, walked in, and the old sergeant sitting behind the desk looked up and saw me and said, "You're in the wrong place, Sarge." I said, "No, Sarge, I'm in the right place. I'm a bloody enemy alien." I think that is the story in a nutshell.
End accession number 3970, reel 5.